Welcome to On the Hill Podcast.
All right, and we're back, man. We're back on the hill.
Back on the hill.
Yeah, man. We got a special guest. We're doing it by Zoom because we're in different parts of the country at the moment.
Yeah, two different states, but same coast.
Not that. Yeah, East Coasters, man. So we'll give you a chance to introduce yourself, and we'll just go from there. So,
yeah. Hey, everybody. I'm Hannah Living Good. I'm coming to you from Charleston, South Carolina. And yeah, I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Of course.
Yeah, no problem. So did you grow up in South Carolina? Where are you originally from?
Yeah, born and raised more in kind of the foothills. So right outside of Charlotte, but very rural at the time. It's now become quite the suburb.
Wow. So you said you're in Charleston now, I guess?
Yeah. Yeah, moved to a little different city. It's like, it's this nice in between, you know, not too big, not too small.
Yeah, I've only been Charleston one time. I went for my bachelor party and we went, I can't remember the name. It's on the water and it seems like it's golf cart community and has like one little strip you could.
One of the islands, Isle of Palms.
It wasn't Isle of Palms.
Folly.
Yep, that's it.
Folly's the party island.
It was fun. It was a lot of fun. That was my first time down there and it was, because we usually go down North Carolina, Outer Banks, Myrtle Beach, but never been to Charleston. So it was cool.
Yeah, it's awesome. Like, great for like bachelor groups, bachelorettes. They have so many of them downtown. It's kind of funny. In the middle of the summer, you just kind of like count how many there are. You take shots. It's a fun game.
That's awesome.
So what, you grew up in the, I don't think you said the community, you might have said it, but.
Yeah, it's called Indian Land.
Oh, wow.
It's where I grew up. It's outside of Charlotte. I just normally say Charlotte, but most people know like Rockville or Fort Mill. Indian Land is really small, very rural. Indian Land High Schools are, you know, like the schools where I went to school. And been there my whole life. My family's from Lancaster and from Salisbury, North Carolina. So I'm a Carolina girl through and through.
Awesome. Yeah, you can't beat that. Yeah, I mean, the South definitely has its own charm. So I did read a little bit on one of your posts about you went to school to be an educator first, and then you made some transitions and stuff. But what kind of education, was there a certain level you think about teaching or?
Yeah, I wanted to teach high school history. And I was, my school at Indian Land in high school was a trade school. So when you enter in, you learned automotive and agriculture and woodworking. So I got all of these trades, and then you picked a certain tract and kind of followed that track through. So I did horticulture, and then I also was in the education track. So I was teaching pretty young. I was doing like student teaching I was like 17 maybe. And so I thought this is great. And I went to university and did education and studied history. I was obsessed with ancient civilizations and religion. So those were kind of my specialties. And then, once I graduated, I went to go work in a school, and I was 22 and I was so small and so young and honestly like pretty unconfident. And those kids ate me alive. So I decided, you know, we'll take a step back from this. I'll return to this maybe one day. And I had to put myself through school. I was doing wilderness guiding to support myself. And so I just went back into wilderness guiding, did that for 8 years. And it was this beautiful combination of being outside, which I have always loved growing up in a rural town, and my parents also were very outdoorsy. So I got to be outside. I got to educate people about, you know, like how humans were interacting with the land and the ecosystem around us. And it was chill, you know, it wasn't super serious. Most of the time we were out there to have fun. Every now and again, something would get really exciting, keep me on my toes. But it was so much better than being in like the fluorescent light of the public school and getting bullied. So that was really kind of how I shifted. And then that led me into a long journey of essentially where I'm at today, because the being outside and being in the wilderness, educating people about the ecosystem, I wanted to know about the plants, about the fauna and the flora. And so I started diving into herbalism, and you know, it was just kind of fun to tell people like, oh, this is yellow dock, like you can eat this, or, you know, this is juniper, you can kind of, you chew on this and it'll make you feel this way.
Wow. So that's pretty interesting. So you guys have a kind of a similar, in a different respect. And it, well, go ahead and just tell her. Yeah. So
I went to college for music education. So I went into student teaching about the same age, like 18, 19. Did, you know, the full 4 years of college, and got out and taught for 5 years. And then decided it wasn't something I wanted to do forever. And the same thing, being stuck in a classroom all day and dealing with the kids and the parents. And it was just, I needed to change. So I went, took a couple classes, and now I do HVAC. I work on heating and air, and I'm outside probably 80% of the day. And, I don't know. It's just a different, it's more,
so different.
Yeah. It's more, I mean, physically demanding, but it is more chill. And I'm, you know, driving around all day, meeting different people, you know, it was a good change. But
yeah, I mean, you're probably like me. I love using my body. Like, I like being physical. I like that challenge. I have a lot of energy, so it's nice to be able to like get it out a little bit. It actually puts me to sleep at night. And right. Also, education is so hard. Being like, you are so many different things for these children, you know? So it's really a tough, career path to take. It's so rewarding in many, many ways, but it's also really hard.
Yeah. No, it's tough. Cause yeah, like you said, you're in charge of 20 plus or sometimes 30 plus kids, and you're trying to get them under control and teach a subject and discipline. Yeah. So it's a lot at one time, but
so much.
Yeah. So I'm just curious about this myself is, so were you teaching history in high school?
Yeah, I did a little bit of teaching of history in high school, and it just like pretty immediately, it was like, this is not for me. Like, yeah. I'm cut out for this at this current juncture. And yeah, so I was like, well, we'll circle back.
Yeah. And the other part before we move on, it sounds pretty, the Indian land schools, it was like a trade school. I mean, that's a pretty, you know, that kind of was, sounds like when I was in school. So I'm 55, I'm probably a lot older than you guys, but, you know, and I graduated in 1987, but you had a lot of those options. We taught a lot of those things you're talking about now back then. And in this area, in Virginia is where we live, they'd taken all that out of school, unless you go to a specific technical school. But I think that's pretty cool that is that still the case now, or have they gotten away from that?
You know, I actually don't know what the school system in Indian land looks like now. If I had to guess, it's probably phased out a little bit, but I really hope that some of that is still intact, because yeah, when I went to school and when I tell people about my experience, they're like kind of confused. They're like, what? because I did get a lot of hands-on work that a lot of people don't experience typically in public school systems. And I feel really grateful for that. Yeah, I actually learned a lot. Like, I have skills that are useful. I know how to work, you know, minorly on my car. I can weld. I can use a lot of tools. Like, I just have really good skills that are useful for life, where I feel like a lot of education now isn't taught. You're not talking about life. You're talking a lot about like the theoretical and the intellectual, which is beautiful and important. But I remember coming out of school feeling really capable, whereas I don't think a lot of people experience that.
I agree with that. Yeah, I think that's big time, because, you know, life skills are very important. So, I'm trying to think where you might want to start, because I did read, you said, I mean, I'm just going off of your Instagram account. So if it's a topic you don't want to talk about, that's great. But you said from dysfunction to, you know, where you are now? So was there a period where you, like, there was some kind of, you know, personal challenges, or you just meant overall in life?
Yeah. So, my experience is, I don't think, unlike many others, particularly women in society, but as a teenager, I experienced several sexual abuses, and it really sent me off the wall. I didn't feel like I could talk to anybody about it. I didn't really know how to handle this scenario. And so I got really into substances. I was doing a lot of drinking, a lot of smoking. And when I went to college, that just got exasperated. So I started exploring sexuality in almost this like hypersexual way. And a lot of people, when you go through sexual abuse or trauma, you kind of go hyper or hypo, meaning you pull away, or you kind of like lean in and go full force. So I leaned in heavily to my sexual experience. And in so many ways, it was really beautiful and explorative and has allowed me to really understand myself on many levels. And also it was kind of perpetuating my own pain because I was trying to find something, but I wasn't really sure what I was looking for. And meanwhile, I'm also experimenting with a ton of new substances in college, and abusing those, and kind of like risky behavior begets risky behavior, you know? So like they were just like feeding into one another. Right. And, what I was like really trying to understand my experience. And so I dove into, again, like religious texts and spiritualism. Nature became like one of my only places of solitude and like where I felt most connected to myself. So I ended up spending so much time in nature, getting a job in nature as a wilderness guide, diving into herbalism, and essentially kind of went on this like wounded healer kind of journey, like just seeking for the answers to heal myself. And I've come so far since then, and trying to communicate this and like share my story with other people in just hopes that they maybe find something that feels inspirational or resonant for them. But when that hit me, dysfunctional to deeply connected, I was thinking about the way that we are dysfunctional. And I describe that as anything that takes us out from our desire. So if we desire to, for example, have an orgasm, but we can't reach it, then it's dysfunctional. It would not be dysfunctional if I didn't care to have an orgasm, then it's not an issue, you know? So if my desire is pulling me there and I can't reach that, then that's what I have determined as dysfunctional. And the way that I've rewoven that for myself is through different spiritual practices, ecosexuality, which probably will be really fun to talk about, herbalism and sensate focused therapy. And weaving all of these things together has like absolutely transformed my life. And I'm just spreading the good word.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. So, I mean, first, thank you for, you know, telling us that. It takes a lot of courage. So, I mean, I didn't say this to you. I'm a retired cop and I used to do sex crimes and work with victims of sexual abuse, children and adults. And I actually work with people now as a therapist, not necessarily on sexual assault, but it could include that. So I'm trying to get back in my own way. I'm also a recovering alcoholic. So I understand the substance abuse part of it, but it'll be 20 years coming up. But I'm saying all that because I like to share that with people too, hoping that anything I say, particularly as it relates to, say, alcoholism, could touch somebody and help them along the way. So that's one of the reasons we started this podcast. I mean, we do have segments that are funny, but we also have some serious ones as well. So, yeah, thank you for sharing that. It takes a lot of courage. But what I wanted to ask you was about the, and I'm being serious about this, the orgasm part of this. Do you find that many women can't reach orgasm, or do you think it's a physical or an emotional reason they can or can't?
Yeah, I think it's very common. unfortunately. And I think it's different for every individual. So dysfunction is kind of a broad term. But in this example of orgasm, it's so unique. I think there is a lot of mental, emotional blockages that happen that stop the physical body from performing in whatever way. So maybe if you go to a physician, they would say, oh, you have anorgasmia. But I think this is one of the issues with kind of medicine in general, is that they want to treat the anorgasmia, but they don't want to treat everything around that. So not looking at the contributing factors of like, how's the home, how's the relationship, what are stress levels, is there trauma, is there abuse, are they on pharmaceuticals? There's like so many different things that contribute to not feeling like somebody can orgasm, not feeling safe to orgasm. And yeah, orgasm also looks very different for everyone. So I think we have this idea of what orgasm is supposed to be, but there's a ton of different types of orgasms, and certain experiences will bring about, different sensations. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's really unique to the individual, but I think it's really common.
Yeah.
So I want everyone to have orgasms at least 3 times in their life.
Hopefully more than that. Yeah. But
hopefully way more.
So, I mean, I guess, when you talk about medicine, we're really referring to Western medicine more than Eastern medicine. And like you said, you study the different religions, but I mean, we know that, Western medicine just wants to treat, the symptom instead of the whole person, where I think Eastern medicine is more holistic. But so I do want to let you talk about the 3 topics you brought up, but I did want to ask you this is within, your connection with nature, do you attribute it to any other, traditional religion, or do you consider that a religion itself? Like Buddhism versus Christianity, or that's kind of where I'm asking you.
Yeah, sure. I grew up Southern Baptist. I actually loved the church for a very long time. And then once I got into high school and I was going through all of these experiences, I was, acting out, as the church might say. And I was pretty open. I've always been a pretty open person. As if you ask me, I'm probably going to tell you. So I wasn't hiding the experiences that I was having outside of the church. And a lot of my peers wanted to discourage that, or kind of like distance themselves from me, even though I know that girl was kissing that boy at the same party I was. Right. But so I kind of distanced myself from the church, and around that time just didn't feel great in that community. And when I went to college, started studying other religions, and I really found a deep resonance in Buddhism. So you'll definitely hear like those kind of like tales of Buddhism, like woven into my personal philosophy. And then I don't know, I've just kind of explored a lot of nature-based religions. Like I was a Wiccan for a little while. I explored a bunch of different pagan religions and ideas. And then I kind of circled back around to Christianity. And I don't personally claim like any one religion at this time, but I have found a new love for Jesus and for Christ, and what the church is trying to do, and what I see across all religions in my experience, is we're all trying to get to the same thing. We're all trying to get to love, peace, joy. We have different ways of accessing that, but we're all just trying to get to the same thing. So I appreciate growing up in the church because it instilled a lot of virtues that I hold, near and dear to my heart today. But right now, I think at one time I probably would have said that I was like in some nature-based religion, but now I just am. I just exist. And I know that there is something higher than myself, or at least that's what I choose to believe, because it gives me a lot of hope. And I think hope is so essential in our crazy world. But yeah, I don't know if I don't think I have any like religion at this point in my life.
That's cool. What do you think about that?
No. Yeah. A little bit of everything. And I was just thinking about you said something about the Western and Eastern medicine and how, I mean, everything about an orgasm is technically physical. And with, I think with the Western doctors trying to, what did you say the doctors called it? When you were unable to have an orgasm?
Oh, inorgasmia.
Inorgasmia. And it sounds like it's just like, well, you got something wrong with you. Here's this. See if this works. When, I mean, I think a lot of it or most of it has to do with it's mental. And like you said, what mental state you're in. And
right.
And I was just wondering how that connects to, like you said, with the environment and in nature, how there is such a physical aspect of it, but most of it in my mind has to do with, you know, that mental state too. And if
yeah,
kind of just brings everything back to, you know,
homeostasis.
Yeah. Just because you out of your normal life. And it's just like, you're just,
I mean,
one with nature. I know this sounds kind of corny, but
yeah, no, I think you're so right. I love the way you've picked up on those, because thinking about, in ancient India, you know, they have the tantric traditions. And Tantra, we in the West are very familiar with Neo Tantra. But the original Tantra teaches that spirit, God, universe, whatever is in all things. And that includes your sexuality, that includes the orgasm, that includes the alcohol, that includes everything. And, in Neo Tantra, which came to the US in like the 1950s or so, and really the counterculture revolution like super latched onto it. It was an emphasis on sexuality and kind of these hedonistic pleasures, which you know, I think it's not wrong. It's just not like the full aspect of what Tantra is. So and I love this idea that in Eastern medicine or vitalist medicine, you're looking at like the entire picture, whereas allopathic or Western medicine, you're again looking at those symptoms and trying to extract this. And I think this is something in US culture that is it's a blessing and a curse, right? Like we're that melting pot. So like even me, like I get to pick and choose all of these things I've learned about ancient religion and make my own religion or my own belief system. And yet a lot of people frown upon that because I don't follow any one thing.
Right.
And I've lost my train of thought here, but I think what I was trying to connect to is that we are very extractive in culture with certain things. But what I want to do is take that and reconnect everything and look at how everything actually is connected. And so like you're saying with the orgasm, which is actually an extremely spiritual experience, it's like this mini ego death. You know, when you orgasm, you're kind of outside your body, but also in it, you know, like there's a lot of different things happening. And there's in sex magic practices, they say that the orgasm is like one of the highest connections to God or source that you could possibly achieve. So this orgasm, if you can't get there, yeah, what's going on? What are we actually like looking at, thinking about? And so again, it's this bridge between not looking at like one thing as a solitary endeavor, but looking at the whole person and the whole experience and the spiritual experience and what, how we weave those together.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. And I have a relationship with Christ, but I don't associate with any particular denomination or anything like that. And I agree that, you know, I think that, I just want to say this to to make you realize or hope, make you realize that we're not judging you in any way. And we just not that kind of people, but certainly I can see where, you know, certain denominations were like, you know, you're either, and I don't believe this at all, you're either this or you're not, you know, you're either baptized at this and you, or you're not going to go to heaven. I've never thought that. And, I just think that I just wanted to let you know that. But the other part of it is, you know, Jesus, he hung out with, you know, the naysayers. He hung out with the sinners, man. So, you know, we're all sinners, and any person that stands in judgment of you is, they don't have that right in any freaking way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's right.
I don't judge anybody. I mean, you got to make decisions about if somebody's safe or unsafe. But what I mean is, as it relates to Christian, you know, as it relates to religion, I don't get to judge anybody, and I don't think anybody should judge you or anybody else. So if I can, I know you got a, you said, I know you had like something going on July 8th. Did that happen or?
Yeah. I had a webinar on ecosexuality. It was very fun. And it's kind of in promotion for a course that I'm putting on the next few weeks. It's all about aphrodisiacs and botanical kink. So it'll be really fun.
Oh, cool. Yeah. And I saw you had something coming up like in November too, but so that, is that true? Yeah. So I'm trying to give you some time to advertise some of this stuff too. But the other part was, so the ecosexuality, let's say like, you know, you wanted to talk about that. So can you kind of explain what that is? And
yeah, so this is really fun. Ecosexuality was kind of coined by these two women, Beth Stevens and Annie Sprinkle, and they're performance artists. So it kind of was this like kind of silly, but kind of not. And they did all of these weddings, like they married a waterfall and they married a dirt crevice, and they did all of these like really outrageous things. But it also was making a statement, as most art does. And they were both queer. And Annie is, I think she was a dancer. She works in the sex industry to some degree. So they kind of blended all of these things, art, activism, environmentalism, sex positivity, and yeah, the earth into what they termed ecosexuality. But they were the first ones to put a label to it, but I really think this existed for a very long time, you know, before that. So that was, I think, 2016 when they first coined that term. But before that, you had the counterculture revolution and this whole hippie movement and the free love and earth and all the things. And then even well before that, you had in the 1800s, transcendentalism, which, you know, is led by artists like Henry David Thoreau and Wilfredo Emerson. And they kind of reimagined our concept of the wild and our relationship to the wild. And then way back in ancient times, you had those nature-based religions that focused on animism. So you kind of can see this trickling through our history, and Beth and Annie just kind of labeled it and made it kind of a thing. And what I really love when I came to find out about ecosexuality is I was already having these really beautiful, powerful experiences in nature. So 2016 would have been at the end of my college career. And before that, I spent almost every day outside. If I didn't have to study, if I didn't, you know, if I wasn't guiding, I was pretty much outside all the time. I was also probably on some kind of psychedelic or on some kind of substance, which really allowed me to get outside of my mental self, my egoic self. And I was having these really beautiful experiences. And I personally felt so lost at this point in my life, trying to understand like who I was, why was I here? What am I supposed to do in the world? I already knew at that point that education in the way of the public school system probably wasn't what I wanted to do, but I just was still doing it because it's what I thought I needed to do. You know, there was just a lot of things where I was still kind of like, I was kind of just going through these motions. Right. And I remember sitting on my favorite rock at the river in Columbia, South Carolina, and looking at everything, all of the water and all the trees, and just being in so much reverence and awe, and having that quote that we hear from the Bible. It's like, all things are made in God's image. And I was like, wow, look at nature. Look at this God in front of me. Right. And then I was like, wait, if God made nature and he like made everything in his image, then I'm also nature. I'm a part of this experience. I am also beautiful. I'm also worthy of love and magic and whatever it is that I was looking for. And I always say that I found my soul in the soil, because it really was me being in the dirt and on those rocks and in the water that I feel like I found my confidence and my self-worth to really begin like building myself back up. And so this was my experience. Simultaneously, I'm diving into herbalism. And one of my biggest goals with herbalism was to try to find plants that would elicit altered states of consciousness without them being alcohol or weed or Xanax or whatever else I was taking.
All right. So were you able to find something though?
Yeah. I mean, I found lots of beautiful plants that really helped me in getting off the substances and at least abusing them, you know? And I also, it was a ton of work. It took many years, and it also was a lot of mindset work to get out of these behaviors that I didn't want to participate in anymore. But yeah, through the earth, I found a different path. And so when I finally learned about ecosexuality, I felt like it had put a label to my personal experience.
I think that people need that, you know, they need that. I mean, it's nice to be able to put a name to it. So we can talk about it, because if you're like, hey, it's like this thing, you know, but we don't know what this thing is. So we get, you know, now you got a definition. So, I mean, were you like experimenting with things? I'm just asking because I'm curious, is things that you found in nature yourself, or I mean, you obviously did some research, but isn't there some danger in taking things you don't know what the outcome may be? I mean, for certain,
could, yes, definitely. I mean, I would not advise people to do the things that I did. But I, you know, definitely did lots of research. I was super curious about poisonous plants. And I was doing some kind of drop dosing with poisonous plants. And through my work with them, I realized that the poison's in the dose. So like all things have the potential to be poison, even those things that we think are good, like healthy food and meditation and whatever you think is good for you, working out, still can be detrimental to your health and to your wellness if the dosing isn't proper. Yeah. So, yeah, I was working with a lot of poisonous plants at the time. I was importing different plants, trying to find different, you know, like the strongest, essentially I wanted the strongest plants I could find.
What did you know what you were looking for? Or you just trying to, what I mean was there like, I'm trying to find this plant to do this, to make me feel this, or were you just trying to find out what, I mean, I don't know. I you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. I mean, were you trying to match a certain plant to a certain high or a certain
emotion or something like that? Or
yeah, I mean, I definitely was, that's what I was trying to do. But I don't think I had the breadth of knowledge that I do now to be like, oh, okay, well, alcohol is a depressant. So right. What plants are going to depress my state? Whereas like Adderall is, you know, kind of elevating. So I want an elevating herb. I was just researching, like this is Gonzo style, just going all in, trying to just like, what can I find that will give me any kind of anything? And, as I was experimenting with plants, I also had to rewrite the story of what it meant to experience pleasure, because these altered states, there's nothing that I have found that is like alcohol. There's nothing that I found that is like Xanax. Like I can get kind of close, but the reason that these substances are so popular and so prolific is because they provide an altered state that is unmatched by many things.
Yeah, I mean, alcohol, you know, people act like all these other drugs are so much more dangerous, but alcohol is a drug that, I mean, it's a magical drug. I mean, I can't drink it because I just go crazy over it. But I mean, it is literally, and I mean, for that case, it was nicotine. So just because something's legal doesn't mean it's safe, but it definitely is hard to match it. I mean, so.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean.
Interesting, like alcohol is so demonized. I feel like, so I swung pretty heavily into like the spiritual conscious community after my experience in college. And everyone there is like, we're sober and we're, which is, you know, no hate. Love that for everyone.
And look, hang on. I love alcohol. I can't drink it because I can't manage it. So
I think that's so key. But I had some really crazy experiences on alcohol, some like very spiritual experiences. And so I think it's so individualistic. Like I can't demonize the substance, but it's my relationship to it. And I have battled that for years and everybody has their own relationship to it. And, you know, so that's all I'll say about alcohol is that it's not, I personally don't think the alcohol is bad. It's their relationship to the thing.
And the bad thing is a lot of times when people get sober, let's say, and like you were saying, you're trying to look at, you're part of these new groups and they're like, I'm sober, I'm this, I'm that. And they want to demonize it, but people demonize things so they don't have to think about it anymore. So if they make it evil, then they can justify not messing with it. I don't think alcohol is evil. I just think that for me, it doesn't work. But well, I think
for their point of view, it's just a way of them trying to find a way to ease their own mind and say, well, I'm better now because I don't do this bad thing. But what made it bad was
their
stress or their relationship with,
well, like you said, whoever. Their relationship with alcohol, but everybody has their own different relationships with it. So that's, I think it's smarter you said that. I agree with that 100%. Yeah. So people like that can get, they kind of wear you out sometimes, you know? Yeah. And they want to demonize people that drink. I've never done that. So, I mean, my kids drink, everybody in my family drinks with me pretty much, but I just can't do it. But so, were you successful in finding the things that you were looking for and like the combinations that you wanted? I know you said you couldn't find them exactly, but let's say I came to like your seminar or any of them in person where people will come, you know, participate as a group, or is it all, you know, on Zoom or something like that?
Yeah, I'm doing one next week in outside of Asheville. And then I'm doing another workshop at, I think the one that you were referencing as in November outside of Wilmington. And those are both on herbal aphrodisiacs. And what I think is cool is that sex is an altered state of consciousness. Mm. So a lot of herbs that I would use to heighten sexuality might also be able to be used to, you know, change your state of consciousness. And I think this is like we were talking about earlier about homeostasis. Our body is in constant, you know, trying to calculate itself out to homeostasis, but anything that we're putting in is changing. So even when you drink water or eat your food, it's shifting your biology and body has to reset. So when we think of it that way, anything that we're applying can alter our state. And so those two on aphrodisiacs are really fun. I would recommend it's kind of like a deeper conversation, but if you want to get some energy, rhodiola is really wonderful, or shatavari root. Actually, something that's kind of close to alcohol, which is the closest thing I've personally found, is kava root. Mm. And it's actually become pretty popular in a lot of recovering communities. That and what's the one people also associate it with? It's another K. But you'll find it a lot at smoke shops is where I found it. So Kaharu is really wonderful. My experience is that it's kind of like alcohol. You know, you have one cup and you're kind of sleepy. At least this is how it reacts to me when I have a glass of wine. I get a little sleepy. I have two glasses or three glasses and I'm kind of ready to party. And then after a fourth glass, I'm done. I'm out. I'm, you know, in bed with my shoes on. And I think kava is kind of that same wave. And it works on the dopamine receptors. So it's helping to build dopamine and build longer, stronger bonds. And there's no hangover. So it's really nice.
That's cool. So,
does it have the same kind of side effects alcohol does? Like if you have too much, are you like off balance, loopy? Like,
yeah, I definitely think it has a very similar effect. Not to the same point of like, it doesn't decrease your motor function as much, but you definitely can feel a little loose. I've driven on kava. I don't know if I would recommend that for every person, but it's, you know, my motor function is there. I felt very safe with doing that. But yeah, you're just like very fun, very silly, especially after a couple cups. It almost had this effect of like MDMA where you're just so happy and so excited. But I think alcohol kind of does that too. And so that's why I think I kind of categorize it more with alcohol, because as soon as it's more of a sedative plant, so it kind of falls under that like sedative, depressive expression, whereas like MDMA and Rhodiola is such an exciting plant. You take a lot of that and you'll be dancing for days.
Wow.
And you're talking about cups. Do brands sell it as a drink or is it more like drops you put in?
So you can do both. When it comes to kava, most of the stores that I've found it in are doing like a powder. So you can boil it or mix it into a tea or a smoothie even. I've seen actually more and more supplement companies putting kava in like whatever blends that they're making. But I normally find it as a powder in the stores locally. And then I'll make like a tea just to extract it more. You can drink it. It kind of tastes terrible. Right. So I would recommend putting some honey in it or mixing it with some other tea or other kind of beverage that you really love. And then, yeah, just taking it like 8 ounces is technically a cup. So that would be like the standard. But I think once you work with it a couple times and know how it interacts with your body, then you might want to take more or less. So I think I definitely recommend starting kind of like in a small dose. But I've also made tinctures out of it, which is like that drop dose that you're talking about. And that's nice because I can carry it around in my pocket. And because it's a sedative, it's working also very well on anxiety. And this is one reason that I drink is social anxiety. So I've gotten to a point where I can just take my tincture of kava to a party and I can just drop dose it. And I don't even need to drink. I don't need to drink a cup of kava. It's just like, you know, it settles me enough to, you know, talk to people and not be awkward. But yeah, there's so many different ways that you can take herbal medicine, which is what I love about it, is that it's so versatile. And you can really find something that like, that you really love.
So if let's say you have your seminar, is it majority? I mean, what is your audience? Is it women, men, combination of both, older people, younger people, or?
Yeah, so that's really interesting. So I just started doing more work online, and I'm finding that my online community, a lot of the community that I have in person is women, but my online community is mostly men. And I think this is actually something that I find really interesting, because that was not my intention. Like, that was not my intended audience. But I find that more and more men are seeking understanding and deeper connection to themselves and to their lovers. And I honestly feel really excited to be a part of all of it. So, a lot of the online webinars are highly like male, but most of my in-person is female. So I'm excited to see how it grows and evolves. It's really fun.
It's pretty cool. So how long are the, I think the one event, it shows three different people, the one in November. Now, is it over 3 days? Is it 1 day?
Yeah, that's an herbal conference. And so there's like the three main speakers, and then all those days, I think it's 2.5 days, will be sprinkled in with other herbalists and specialists like myself. That one's going to be packed full of content and experience. It's going to be really great. I'm going to have a lot of plants for tasting, which will be fun. So we can all leave feeling real sexy on our way to our next herbalist. Yeah, that one's going to be really fun. That one's the Southeastern Herbal Conference.
Right. We have your information. So send us the information. We'll put it on the podcast too at the bottom so people can look it up and stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So do you have any other friends that say, like, you know, what does your day look like? I mean, this is 100% of your time, or are you intermingling with other things? Or I guess what I'm trying to say is a community where you are now that's involved in this? So when you're out there, you know, you got other people with you, or is it all this kind of just you yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I have an amazing community of people who are not necessarily doing the same things that I do, but they're just like my family. They're my support system. I love them to death. I don't think I would feel as confident to do what I do without them. But I don't have many people in Charleston or in my network that are doing this exact work that I'm doing. But there's a handful of us out there, and I know that I stand alongside a lot of amazing pioneers. All of my teachers, you know, I'm taking what I'm doing personally is taking a lot of information that I've gathered from different kind of communities, like all this information from the herbal community. I've studied sexology, so I'm taking a lot from sex education and sex therapy. A lot of my personal experience, the environmentalist movement, so I'm pulling threads from all of these different things. And there's a couple philosophers who speak on the eroticism of life. And so I pull threads from that. And so it's both there's a collective, and it's also just me.
No, that's cool though. I mean, yeah. So I mean, what is your long-term goal? Are you thinking like maybe writing a book or something? Or are you thinking about, I mean, I don't know. I'm just asking, you know, what do you think?
I think my vision for this is I just want to serve and help people. And I don't know, I'm open to whatever form that takes.
Right.
When I was young, I always wanted to write a book, so I am not opposed to that. I'm just kind of open. Right now, I went full time on this business. I've had Herbal Hedonism for 3 years, and I went full time 3 months ago, 2.5 months ago. It's a whirlwind. So I'm just allowing kind of like whatever to unfold, follow my inspiration and allow people to tell me like what they want and just serve in the best way that I can.
So when you say you do herbal hedonism, you went full time, but what is that like a, what is that exactly?
Herbal hedonism is my business. So I, on Instagram, if you follow me, I'm the Herbal Hedonist. Right. And my business is Herbal Hedonism. I do workshops, one-on-one clients, and I have a small apothecary. So I make medicine for people. I work kind of longer term, small one-on-one container, and then I have the workshops that I do.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah, small but mighty.
Yeah, that's awesome.
No, that's cool. I think it's great. Yeah, I just want to make sure you could get it out there what it was. I mean, yeah. You know. So you've got the Instagram. Is there, like you said, there a webpage too, or are you working on that?
Yeah, you can go to herbalhedonism.com, look at all the juicy details, anything that's coming up. It's all right there.
Cool. Yeah. Wait, you got anything else you want to?
I don't know. I mean, is there anything else you wanted to touch on and share?
Yeah, I feel great. I'm open to, you know, however y'all want to take this conversation, if you want to lead it. But also I feel pretty complete.
Yeah. I didn't know if there was, you know, you mentioned three things. I didn't know if we covered them all or not. So I don't want to make sure.
Yeah, I know we covered the eco pretty good. I can't remember the other two that you said.
Yeah, we explored herbalism, ecosexuality, and honestly, I'm not sure one of the other thing I was. I said I talk a lot, so.
Yeah, they're the aphrodisiacs. I mean, so I'm just curious. So if somebody came to you, and this is probably the last question, I guess, Wes, but in these, particularly the in-person sessions, do couples come? And then, I mean, I guess I'm trying to picture this thing. So let's say, like, is it, like people go out of the country and experiment, because you can't do it in the States. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you follow other podcasts or watch them, but like, I'm trying to think of somebody like, well, a lot of vets are doing this too. You know, they're using, I think you said it was MDMA or whatnot, and it can't do it here legally. So they go, you know, Mexico or other places, South America, Central America. And they go through these, they take the medication, but it's, you know, it's supervised and it's supposed to be safe and it's supposed to help, you know, like you said, people find their inner selves. But I mean, not every experience for these people, like one of the guys, his name is Sean Ryan. He has a podcast. I think he did it and he was trying to deal with PTSD. So I guess I'm just trying to ask you a question. Am I saying it right? MDMA?
Yeah. MDMA.
MDMA. Yeah. So have you tried that or?
Yeah, I have. I use it mostly in like a recreational setting. It's a goal of mine to go about it in more of a therapeutic way. But I've taken, large doses of psilocybin, like 5 grams of psilocybin, which is, considered a heroic dose. And I've done that very therapeutically. And I've worked with LSD therapeutically, as well as cannabis, which I don't think a lot of people think about doing cannabis in a therapeutic way, but it is one, it's super accessible. Right now. And if you think about the things that you need to think about, like set and setting, and just allow yourself to dive in, even something as simple as cannabis can be pretty transformative. But my friend, a good friend of mine, went through an MDMA trial here in the States, doing research. So I think there's a lot going on in the scientific community kind of trying to shift perspectives around, you know, that very thing that you're talking about. Even ketamine comes to mind. In Charleston, there's a ketamine center, so you can go and get ketamine therapy. And I'm not sure what like all the legalities are of that, but I know that it's transforming many people's lives. I also know that working with substances without a professional can be very damaging for many people.
Right.
And you never really know what kind of experience you're going to have. And that's why having somebody with you or having the set and setting being appropriate is really important. But yeah, as far as what that looks like with my clients, I don't personally work with psychedelics or, you know, these other pharmaceutical substances. If somebody came to me and asked for that, I might consider, but I wouldn't personally offer that out on the table just because I'm not trained. And to me, training is very important just so that I'm making sure everyone is as safe as possible. But for me, what that looks like is going in with a client. I don't typically work with couples at the moment, but kind of just diving into what the sexual experience is, what you want it to look like, kind of working on mindset, working on our emotional state, and working on the physical body. So kind of building in that trifecta of like the bio, social, and psycho model, and just like bringing it all together and looking at how all of these things intersect. I use herbalism to work on like the physical body. I use essences, herbal essences, to work on the spiritual and emotional body. And then it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of therapeutic. It's kind of like a coaching call. It has many layers to it, but we'll work together for a few weeks to a month, depending on what exactly it is that we're working through. But all the sessions are tailored to each individual. And it's really fun because I get to work with people who are on pharmaceuticals who might want to come off. We do a lot of re-education around what pleasure is and what sexuality is, and just help people tap into something that feels more deeply connected and more deeply true to them.
So a lot of people who come and ask you these type of questions and need help, are they mostly looking for, I figure out how to word it. I guess like just better orgasms and better sexual experiences, or is it more like they're trying to find a safe place and just achieve a kind of a normal sexual experience? Like if they've had trouble in the past or they've just had bad experiences. You always hear the saying like post orgasmic clarity or post nut clarity. Is just like you kind of feel guilty or, you know. Mm. I'm just kind of, is it most people are trying to just achieve that just a normal feeling, or is it more like they're just trying to get a better experience out of it?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both. You know, you definitely have the people who just want to have, who have a lot of shame and guilt around their sexuality, you know, what you call post-nut clarity, and the guilt that may come with it. It's so we tease that apart, you know, like why is guilt and shame coming up? You know, where do these stories come from that sex is bad or that pleasure is bad? And, you know, so kind of there is definitely this like very emotional mental state. And then there's people who come for very practical, you know, physiological ailments. And almost always there's the mental emotional side of that as well. But I think at this moment, I'm attracting a lot more of that emotional, mental, like rewiring clientele. So that's exciting. But yeah, so it's a little bit of both.
That's awesome.
That's a good question.
I was just wondering because I know, and everyone experiences it in some way. And I think it's great what you're doing is just trying to make it just seem normal and natural. And
I mean, it really is nothing more natural. I mean, but that's the problem. I mean, particularly like you said, growing up in the church and everything else, you know, don't do this, don't do this. And it's like, you know, let's be real. You know, I think we raise our kids to be real. So
I like that. Let's be real. Let's be wild.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I'm down with that. Might be why you got a lot of male followers. Cause you know, that message is out there. You know, dudes, I mean, I'm not saying us, but dudes, a lot of dudes are just trash, man. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, I like that y'all keep it real on the hill.
Hell yeah. Thank you for that. I did have a question, but damn, I forgot it. Damn. This is kind of a funny question. I hope you don't take offense, but does size matter? You know, that's always guys are wondering about.
No, honey, it's not about the size. It's the way you move it.
Yeah. I know. So, I mean, this is all right. So now we're having a little fun, but a friend of mine, this is real. I don't want to say his name, but. The dude's got like micro penis, but I mean, but he still pulls a lot of chicks. I don't know how he does it, man. But anyway,
he's a funny dude.
But yeah, so I'm not saying you personally, but let's say like, you know, you're out with a guy and then, you know, he's nice looking. I mean, and this is just a made up scenario. You're not taking offense to this, right?
No.
Yeah. So then, and then he pulls out, you know, y'all get ready to, you know, have intercourse and then he's got like this micro penis. I mean, you think that doesn't matter or I mean, should this dude feel okay with that or as long as he's doing okay, I guess? Or
yeah. I mean, I think that there's You know, I think that there's a similar stigma on women's bodies. If women's bodies don't look a certain way, then, you know, will...
That's true, yeah.
Now, you know, does somebody want to engage with them? And it's kind of a multifaceted question, right? It's like, I think everybody has the right to have their preferences. And I don't think that if you have a genuine connection with somebody and you're really liking where things are going, I don't think it should be the end all be all. So if you're going to stop things right there because the bot, like somebody's physical vessel doesn't match with like what your ideal is, you might be missing out. Like, you don't know.
Yeah, that's true. Kind of a shallow way of thinking. Well, not you. I'm saying if someone decides, you know, I didn't want to do something
with somebody. I know the dude's going to watch the show. So I was hoping that maybe, you know, you would give him some hope, you know, that, hey, it's okay. You're going to be all right, brother. You know,
I think he'll be all right.
Yeah. I got to do. So on every show I do, I just ask the same question. If you were on death row and you had one final meal, this has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but if you had one final meal, what would it be?
The first thing that comes to mind is like the juiciest steak.
Mm. So yeah. you're not like vegan or nothing. I meant to ask you that.
No. I mean, I did the vegan thing for all of 2 months. I couldn't do it. It just wasn't for me.
So
yeah, juicy. No disrespect, but I love meat.
Any sides, just a steak? Because I know you're from
Carolina. Okay, mac and cheese, super cheesy. The cheesiest cheesy mac and cheese.
Mm-hmm.
A rare steak, like medium rare.
Damn.
And probably some like collard greens.
I was hoping you'd say collard. I knew you're from Carolina, so I...
You intuited that.
All right. I just, when I ask that question, I think I learn a lot about somebody. So
it's a well-balanced meal, but I'm obsessed with cheese. So
what about your drink? What would you have to drink with it?
Okay. Wow. That's a tough one. So recently I've been obsessed with coconut water. I've like found this new love for coconut water. I actually hate coconut. So it feels like it's really exciting discovery. But I think I'd probably have to pair a glass of wine with my steak.
There you go.
Nice red, a deep red Cabernet.
There you go.
I could have.
It's like, that really is, I want that right now.
Yeah. So, I mean, we had you on for this episode, but I mean, we might have to have you on again.
Yeah. Let's bring it back round two.
Yeah. So, and you know, you get to know somebody and, these open formats are rare, really. I mean, they're more accessible now because of, you know, technology. But, you know, so many people, you know, we're so used to TV shows being 30 minutes or, you know, a show is an hour or something like that. Or the news is, you know, I mean, they had this narrative they try to follow. So, you know, we're privileged with the idea of that you'd even consider coming on. And we hope that it helps your business. And we hope that you get this message out and maybe we can check back up and like, a couple months, 6 months or something like that, or sooner, and let us know what's going down.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you all so much for having me.
Yeah. And if you ever have a podcast, maybe you can have us on, man.
Yeah. I was thinking about starting one the other day. So maybe you will be on there.
Yeah. Well, that'd we appreciate it. Yeah. We wish you the best of luck and, you know, just be safe and, you know, and what you're doing. That's all.
Thank you all so much.
Yeah. That's the dad in me saying that shit. So.
You stay safe out there.
Thank you for listening to On the Hill. Like, subscribe, and follow us wherever you listen to your podcasts. See ya.